Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone, and happy Veterans Day, vets, and thank you for your service. We'll have a Veterans Day call-in later this hour. But we begin with impeachment coverage. Today, the prehistory of the Trump-Ukraine scandal. With the first public hearing scheduled for this Wednesday and Friday, how did we really get here? Philip Bump and Aaron Blake from The Washington Post have put together what they call the full Trump-Ukraine timeline. Philip Bump joins us now to talk about the 5 years, yes, 5 years, leading up to the infamous Trump-Zelensky phone call in July of this year and the larger scheme to tie military aid and a White House meeting to Ukraine investigating Trump's political rivals. Philip, we appreciate this really useful timeline and your own time today. Thanks for coming on.
You bet.
It's called the full Trump-Ukraine timeline, but it really starts almost 3 years before Trump becomes president. Your first entry is February 22nd, 2014, when the pro-Russia president, Viktor Yanukovych, is ousted during a popular uprising against him, and he flees to Russia. Why start there?
That's a great question, because it actually does go well before that, as I'm sure probably most listeners know. We decided to start at that point because that was really the trigger point for most of the tension between Russia and the U.S. It was a pro-Russian leader in Ukraine who was ousted by out of popular demand, and that really started the tension between those two countries, which I think informed a lot of what followed.
Your timeline notes that Yanukovych had come to power with the help of Paul Manafort,
right,
who would go on to be Trump's campaign chairman. Why did Paul Manafort, an American political consultant, want to help the guy who was helping Russia expand its influence by dominating Ukraine?
Because they gave him money to do that. Paul Manafort was never one who was putting ethics before profits. He worked over for a long period of time with a number of people of questionable repute, including in the Philippines and in other places. And he was very involved in what was called the Party of Regions, which was Yanukovych's political party, helped him get into that position, which then later on, I don't want to, you know, give any spoilers here, but we'll come back to burn him and be involved in all this in the future.
And the next month, March 2014, a month after Manafort's client Yanukovych is forced out, Russia isn't having this new resistance to it, and that's when it invades the Ukrainian peninsula of Crimea and annexes it, such a pivotal event, just takes it back as part of Russia, March 2014. 2 months later, May 13th, 2014, Hunter Biden joins the board of Burisma, owned by Mykolas Lochevsky, one of several subjects of a Ukrainian corruption probe. Can you tell us more about that? What kind of corruption was Lochevsky suspected of?
So it's fairly wide-ranging. I mean, it's important to keep in mind that at the time, and continuing to the present to some extent, there are a lot of questions about the way that power is exercised in Ukraine. This is we tend to think of oligarchs as being something that is Russian, but there are certainly oligarchs that are also Ukrainian. This is a situation where there was, for example, they had if I'm remembering correctly, it's fairly detailed, but a fraudulent lease on an oil storage container or something along those lines. There were a lot of ways in which Burisma had sort of risen to the attention of authorities, and then authorities weren't really doing a whole lot with it. And so the fact that Hunter Biden joined the board at that point in time is certainly something that raised a lot of eyebrows.
And why did Hunter Biden, son of the sitting vice president at that time, 2014, join Burisma's board?
It's a good question. I don't know that I've heard a really detailed response from him on that. I think that his motivation was probably not unlike Paul Manafort's, which is that they were paying him money to do that, right? I mean, he was in the business of providing advisory services to companies. And my guess is that was probably a primary motivator.
And now here comes something related to that I think we're very likely to hear about on day one of the public hearings on Wednesday. The point on your timeline is early 2015 now, and one of the witnesses who will testify on Wednesday, State Department official George Kent, raises concerns about Hunter Biden's work with Burisma, but Joe Biden's office turns him away, as you put it. Can you elaborate on what George Kent's concern was about Hunter Biden being on that board and what he says the interaction with Joe Biden's office was like?
Yeah, so, I mean, his concerns, there were obvious reasons, and this actually came up later during President Obama's actual administration. There are obvious reasons to be concerned about Hunter Biden's involvement with this company and his involvement with Ukrainian power more broadly. Kent says that he raised this issue with Biden's office. This was at the time when Beau Biden, Joe Biden's other son, was dying of brain cancer. And so he was told, essentially, look, we don't have time to worry about Hunter Biden right now. We're the vice president's focused on Beau Biden. But the impression that one gets from Kent in particular is that he was not particularly satisfied with the response that he got in terms of his concerns about that possible conflict.
So I guess we'll hear Republicans question him about that on Wednesday. But the next four entries on your timeline are about people wanting Ukraine's chief prosecutor, Viktor Shokin, fired for not investigating corruption. And these seem to establish that the way the Trump people are trying to portray Joe Biden's role in getting that Ukrainian prosecutor, Viktor Shokin, fired at the time is totally misleading. So here we go. September 24th, 2015. Jeffrey Pyatt, then U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, blasts Shokin in a speech in Odessa, Ukraine. He points to a glaring problem that threatens the good work regional leaders are doing, the failure of the institution of the Prosecutor General of Ukraine to successfully fight internal corruption. Then October 8th, 2015, Assistant U.S. Secretary of State Victoria Nuland testifies to the Senate that Shokin's office has to be reinvented as an institution that serves the citizens of Ukraine rather than ripping them off. That's a quote. Then December 8th, 2015, in Kiev, Biden tells Ukrainian leaders to fire Shokin or lose more than $1 billion in loan guarantees. That's what the Republicans are calling Biden's quid pro quo. But for context, as you point out, Biden joins many Western leaders in urging Shokin's ouster. And as a further example of that, a few months later, February 10th, 2016, the International Monetary Fund threatens to halt a bailout program for Ukraine unless the country addresses its issues, which includes firing Viktor Shokin. Right. So the point there, very important point, is there's overwhelming evidence that Viktor Shokin was not fired as a way to ease up on Hunter Biden. The whole Western world wanted him fired because he wasn't investigating corruption in Ukraine.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, focusing on Shokin, the idea from Republicans is that Shokin was going hard against Burisma and therefore Joe Biden wanted to crack down on him. And it's, in fact, the opposite is the case, is that Shokin wasn't cracking down on corruption, that Burisma, there's not evidence beyond from Shokin himself, who obviously is not a reliable narrator here. There's not evidence that Burisma was actually under investigation at the time that that Shokin was fired. Shokin was essentially, according to all these various people, falling down on the job and not actually tackling this systemic problem that had Americans concerned. Americans were concerned at that time legitimately about how much do we support Ukraine when Ukraine is a corrupt political institution. Shokin being there was seen as an obstacle to real reform, and that is why all of these leaders, including at that time Joe Biden, were focused on him and his removal.
And then on March 29th, 2016, Shokin is finally fired. You don't have this in your timeline, but I find it interesting that he's only finally fired in the weeks after the International Monetary Fund threatened to halt a bailout program. So maybe it had nothing to do with Joe Biden or the U.S. Secretary of State or the U.S.-Ukraine ambassador, but it was when the IMF said they're going to withhold the green that they finally fired Viktor Shokin.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there was a culmination of a lot of different pressures that Ukraine was feeling at that point in time.
August 14th, 2016, Ukrainian officials reveal the existence of a handwritten ledger suggesting that Paul Manafort, then Trump's campaign chairman, had received millions in off-the-books payments from Yanukovych's political party, the pro-Russia party. 5 days later, August 19th, 2016, it's in the middle of the summer, Republican convention is around then, and Manafort is forced to resign as Trump's campaign chairman because of this handwritten ledger. Now, the Trump people are pushing what seems to be a conspiracy theory about the ledger that they're using as an argument for why it was okay to demand Ukraine investigate 2016 as a condition this year for military aid. Can you explain what's known about this handwritten Paul Manafort ledger?
Sure. So at the time, in August 2016, there was a Ukrainian member of parliament and an anti-corruption organization which released these documents. Essentially what happened is when Yanukovych was forced out of office, the citizens just raided his estate and his compound and party offices, and they pulled out all these various documents. So some of these documents appear to detail millions of dollars of under-the-table payments to Paul Manafort, some of which was actually part of the criminal charges that he faced last year. And so these documents were then made public in August 2016. There was, at the same time, obviously an effort from anti-Trump forces to try and dig up dirt on Paul Manafort. Everyone knew Paul Manafort had some sketchy ties in his background. They were certainly looking for things like this. And so the argument that's being made is, especially because I should note that last year, or it was 2017 or 2018, there was also a finding by a Ukrainian court in which they said that this was an attempt to interfere with the 2016 election. That finding was later thrown out, but it sort of set the seeds for, was this Ukraine proper trying to interfere in the election by targeting Manafort? And so that's some rhetoric that we've been hearing.
Listeners, we can take some phone calls for Washington Post national correspondent Philip Bump, who has co-authored with his colleague Aaron Blake from the Post a very lengthy and detailed timeline of Trump-Ukraine that, as you've been hearing, if you've been listening the last few minutes, starts all the way back in 2014. And if you have any questions about what we're calling the prehistory of Trump-Ukraine, anything before, let's say, the summer of this year when it started breaking into the news, we can take those questions at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. January 12th, 2017, Trump is already elected. It's 8 days before he's sworn in, and Ukraine closes its investigation of Burisma, though the new chief prosecutor, Lutsenko, says one sale of an oil storage terminal will still be investigated. Do you know basically what they found ultimately in the investigation of Burisma corruption?
I don't. And it's interesting because this is actually Burisma saying at that point in time, all of these things have been closed. So we're not really sure on when they were actually closed out. Because again, remember, the idea is that in the late 2015, early 2016 timeframe, when Shokin was being targeted, Burisma wasn't apparently under investigation. So this may have been something that had emerged after that under the new president, Petroshenko, who of course is not currently the president. So it's not really clear what actually happened with the Burisma thing. That's part of one of the mysteries here. And part of that too stems from the fact that Ukraine's politics are a little murky.
And that date is interesting in part, as I think you were suggesting in that answer, the investigation of Burisma was not closed when Joe Biden was president, suggesting some kind of pressure to save Hunter Biden from anything that they may have acted on, only after Biden was leaving.
Right.
So that helps establish that there's no evidence for that. However, let's jump ahead to something in your timeline that perhaps could help Trump's defense. January 11th, 2017, or I guess we're really jumping back one day, so it's the same week, January 11th, 2017, just before Trump is inaugurated, Politico reports that Ukrainian officials, quote, helped Clinton's allies research damaging information on Trump and his advisors during the campaign, unquote. Now, Philip, it seems to me this could become central to a Trump defense, that getting campaign help from a foreign country is more common than the press and the Democrats are making it seem. And oh, by the way, both parties do it, and both parties did it in 2016. But how much was that Politico angle proven?
Right. No, it's a great point. And I think it's important to remember, January 2017, the media was obsessed over what we were just then learning about Russia's role interfering in the 2016 election. Again, it was 2 months prior the election actually occurred. So we were just starting to learn that the CIA and the FBI were concerned about what Russia had done. And so Politico comes out and says, hey, we've uncovered this Ukrainian thread too. The big difference is the scale of the efforts, right? The Ukraine effort, there was a woman who worked as a consultant for the Democratic National Committee who has subsequently been called as a potential witness by Republicans in this House inquiry. But she was essentially trying to dig up. She went to the Ukrainian embassy and said, hey, what do you got on Manafort? Because again, as I said, people were really focused on, look, there's got to be something we can find on Paul Manafort given his history. So that's one of the really central parts of this political piece, is a woman from the DNC went to the Ukrainian embassy and asked them for help on Manafort. That's very very, very different than both the scale of what happened with Russia in 2016 and who was actually leading the effort. I mean, that was, according to reports, driven by Vladimir Putin himself saying, let's focus on this in 2016. So it's very different, but you're exactly right. Donald Trump and his allies are very much, you know, they're very prone to sort of whataboutism, and they have lifted up this article repeatedly as an example of Ukraine being a bad actor as well or equivalently.
Ahead 3 months now to April 21st, 2017. So Trump is in office for a few months, and he, for the first time, tweets this conspiracy theory that Russia didn't hack the DNC and release all those emails damaging to Hillary Clinton in the final weeks of the campaign. It was actually Ukraine that hacked the DNC, and they did it not to help Trump, but to help Clinton. And now this is widely called a debunked conspiracy theory by now, we should say. Right. But what was the theory even based on? How could dropping all those bad for Hillary emails be a way to help her win the election?
So again, keep in mind that what Donald Trump is trying to do at this point, he's very concerned about the Russian investigation at this point. April 2017, right before he fires James Comey, he'd been asking James Comey behind the scenes, according to Comey, hey, you lift this cloud, I've got Russia hanging over my head. So what Donald Trump's trying to do here is distract. And so there was this conspiracy theory that emerged during the 2016 campaign, shortly after the Washington Post actually first reported in June 2016 that Russia had hacked this material. There's this conspiracy theory that emerged, and that the link goes, the first analysis of the DNC server was done by a company called Cloudflare. A guy who helped co-found Cloudflare sits on the board of this nonprofit organization. That nonprofit organization receives some funding from a Ukrainian oligarch. That's the tie that is the ostensible link between Ukraine and the server. It's you know, calling it debunked is generous. It's nonsensical in a lot of ways. It is also the focus of what would later be Trump's first ask to President Zelensky.
Just for the record, Cloudflare, or I think I've heard CrowdStrike, yes.
Not to disparage a company unfairly, yes.
CrowdStrike is the name of that company. We have a call on this part of the timeline. Let's take it. Debbie in Lacey, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. I have a question because I heard this theory proposed by Rachel Maddow over a month ago. And the question was everything that Trump did all motivated by his desire to relieve the sanctions on Russia? In other words, sanctions were put on them for interfering in the election. So if he could somehow prove that Ukraine had done it and not Russia. And secondly, if he could also have Russia and Ukraine make peace, and then that would relieve the sanctions that were put on for Russia invading Ukraine and annexing Crimea.
It's an interesting theory, Debbie. It's not one that I've heard before, but Philip, maybe you have. She says Rachel Maddow talked about it on MSNBC, and it's interesting as a theory that Trump didn't really think it would absolve him of anything having to do with saying, Russia, if you're listening, and all that stuff that he did right out in public in 2016, but it might help him have an excuse to lift the sanctions on Russia. And so if he's really a pawn of Putin, this is something, or owes Putin something, that it could have been leading up to that.
I feel very comfortable. This is a New York-based radio station, so I think people are familiar with the pre-Donald Trump as president Donald Trump. And so I would ask, which seems more likely, Donald Trump trying to come up with some sort of machination to lift these sanctions, or Donald Trump being mad everyone thinks he didn't win the election under his own steam, right? And I think he really is legitimately irritated that people think Russia handed him the presidency. I think he would also love to be able to show the Russia probe was wrong because, again, he could, you know, say, stick it to his enemies. I think that's probably a more likely scenario.
We're doing the prehistory of Trump Ukraine from 2014 till May of this year with Philip Bump from The Washington Post, who wrote this up in great detail. May 2nd, 2018. Now we get into last year. Ukraine stops cooperating with Robert Mueller in the Russia investigation. Then May 4th, 2 days later, three Democratic senators, Durbin, Leahy, and Menendez, write to Ukraine's prosecutor, Lutsenko, to ask him to reconsider. Now, Philip, Trump supporters will ask, why was a foreign country cooperating with the Mueller investigation into a U.S. political scandal? And is that any different from what Trump was asking Ukraine to do, is asking Ukraine to do, with investigating their theory of 2016 election interference on the other side?
Right. And I think that's a fair question. I think it's important to note that this the New York Times reported that Ukraine had been reticent to help the Mueller probe, recognizing how President Trump felt about the Mueller probe. And so they were sort of making a geopolitical decision. Do we go out of our way to anger Donald Trump by helping with this thing? This was a probe that was sanctioned by Donald Trump's own Justice Department. This was a special counsel that was appointed by, you know, the Deputy Attorney General. It was a very different thing than Donald Trump sort of speculatively saying, hey, maybe there's something on Joe Biden. If you could find something, dig something up, or at least make an announcement about it, that would be helpful.
And based on what we discussed before, maybe the difference is the Mueller investigation was real. The whole intelligence community concluded Russia hacked the DNC, and Mueller actually indicted a dozen individual Russians with mountains of evidence, while the theory that it was really Ukraine was only ever a political trick, a fabrication made up to cast doubt on the Russia investigation to help save Trump. So, of course, Ukraine would help with one and not help with another.
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, Ukraine, part of what we're seeing in the most recent testimony is Ukraine found itself in the same geopolitical bind once Trump started making those asks. But it certainly was rational for Ukraine to have a response of, okay, this is a legitimate investigation versus this is something that is the will of the president.
Now we get to this year and some of the intrigue that we'll be hearing about in the public hearings. You have on March 20th of this year, Ukraine's chief prosecutor, Yuri Lutsenko, tells a pro-Trump American journalist, John Solomon of The Hill, that our ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, gave him a list of people who we should not prosecute. In other words, Yovanovitch is being tarred as corrupt, it's at least implied there, and trying to protect corrupt people. But you're right that the State Department called the claim an outright fabrication at the time. So let me focus on that. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, State Department, defended Yovanovitch?
Yeah, I mean, this was a claim that was later retracted by Lutsenko a month or two later. It was pretty obviously not true, and it was, in fact, Lutsenko trying to give information. I mean, keep in mind that at this point in time as well, Ukraine is going through its next presidential election. Lutsenko is the general prosecutor. He's worried about his job. He thinks that if the then-current president, Petroshenko, is out of office, he may lose his position. And so he is, it seems, quite likely that he is actually trying to engage in some political machinations that will boost Petroshenko's chances.
By endearing themselves to the Trump administration?
Yes, exactly.
Because they already know Trump doesn't like Yovanovitch.
Right. And they also know by now that Rudy Giuliani is very actively trying to dig up dirt in Ukraine. And so they're trying to give him this. And Giuliani and Solomon have an interesting relationship through another pair of lawyers that's very complex and detailed. But so Giuliani has this tie to Solomon. Solomon's interviewing this guy. Giuliani has already talked to people who are involved in this whole thing as well. So all of this is sort of an emergence to the surface of something that's sort of been in the works for months, trying to figure out how they talk about Ukraine in Trump-friendly terms.
Huh. So Lutsenko must be completely discredited now. If he retracted this, does that mean that he admitted that he just made up this smear on Ambassador Yovanovitch to endear himself with Trump, just made up something this serious?
I don't remember the contours of his admission that it was false, so I don't know how detailed he got about his rationale for doing it, but he did admit that it was not accurate.
And the next month, April 24th of this year, Ambassador Yovanovitch gets that 1 a.m. phone call that's been in the news now from a State Department official that Yovanovitch revealed at her testimony recently, telling her to come home from Ukraine on the next plane for the sake of her security.
Right.
Now, Yovanovitch will testify on Friday. First witnesses on Wednesday. Yovanovitch on Friday this week will get her take on all these things. Philip, most of the public started to hear only in September about Trump and Rudy and the shadow foreign policy toward Ukraine, right, designed to advantage Trump personally. But all of this stuff we've just been talking about took place in earlier months this year. That phone call to Yovanovitch was in April. That made up smear against her by the Ukrainian prosecutor was in March. Most of the public started to hear about all this only in September after the whistleblower complaint,
right,
became public. But in May of this year is when this story did begin to break out publicly a little bit for people paying really close attention to the news. May 1st, the New York Times publishes an article asking whether Biden's role in pressing for Prosecutor Shokin's ouster back in 2014, 2015, had anything to do with Hunter Biden being on the board of Burisma and portraying it as a potential liability to Biden's 2020 campaign. But then May 7th, 6 days later, a Bloomberg News article casts doubt on the Times article. Can you explain how the two news organizations were at odds in the first week of May?
Well, I think part of it is the function just of the, you know, I keep using the word murky, but with justification. It's really unclear about what was going on at that point in time. And the people at the center of it, Shokin and Lutsenko, for example, were not necessarily always forthright in terms of what they'd actually done. I think it's important to note that that May article in the Times is from Ken Vogel, who actually happened to be the same guy at Politico who'd reported the first Ukraine thing, which I always find an interesting parallel. But essentially what Bloomberg had done is looked at what had been reported by the Times on May 1st and sort of dug into it a little bit further and found some of the gaps that we now recognize. Since, of course, the whistleblower complaint was made public, a lot more gaps have emerged and you know, the extent to which there probably wasn't even a lot of smoke there has been revealed.
May 9th this year, Rudy Giuliani tells the New York Times he will travel to Ukraine to push for investigations. And right away, Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut tweets that everyone should take note that the president is asking a foreign country to investigate his political rival. Not much of the press did take note that early May 9th. So this really, however, for people who were paying attention, broke out in May.
Yeah, I think that's safe to say. You know, and the Giuliani, I think that his interview with the Times on May 9th will become one of the key factors here, because in that interview, he essentially says, I was working for my client. If this happened to benefit the United States more broadly, then great. When, again, remember that Trump's argument is that he was solely thinking about what was good for the United States and rooting out corruption in Ukraine and not trying to give them money if they were a corrupt organization or a corrupt country. That Giuliani was so forthright in going to Ukraine and trying to dig this dirt up specifically for Trump's personal benefit, I think will become something that sort of hovers over all of this.
Veronica in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Philip Bump from The Washington Post. Hi, Veronica.
Hi, Brian. I remember distinctly the leak that happened in May 2018. Mueller investigation is being blocked by the Ukraine. They're no longer cooperating. And only one news source, and it was on NPR, stating a leak that Trump had supplied the Ukraine with ammunition and planes. I remember that distinctly, and I heard it on no other news source. Oh, no, Rachel did it too. But other than that, that was it, and it stopped. But a direct leak.
Thank you. And I don't remember hearing this, Philip. Is this something you know, that at the time that they said they were not going to cooperate with Mueller or didn't want to cooperate with Mueller, that suddenly some military aid was released then?
I know that there was, I believe it was actually an editorial in the Post last week that sort of looked at whether or not this question of quid pro quo had gone back further than 2018. Honestly, I don't remember the contours of that, so I can't really speak to it. But it is the case that the Trump administration did provide lethal military aid to Ukraine, which is something, again, that the president talks about with some regularity.
Igael in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. My question is this. We have seen in the reveal of the communication with Ukraine that Trump has done a quid pro quo, and I'm almost positive that he's done more quid pro quo with more head of states that he's been in conversation with since the beginning of his presidency. How long will we have to wait to get these calls, to make these calls public? Because I'm sure there's more evidence that he is running the country for his benefit.
Well, I think that there are a lot of legitimate reasons that these conversations between President Trump and foreign leaders would be kept under wraps. You know, obviously there is an exceptional nature to this particular conversation, the July 25th call that has become a focus of so much attention, and that the White House reportedly tried to spirit it away to this super secure server, which is abnormal. The fact that Bill Taylor, who is the acting ambassador in Ukraine, says that he was never even briefed on that conversation, which is very bizarre, since obviously this was a conversation that affected him directly. That said, there certainly are reasons that there are times in which the president doesn't want to actually reveal the contents of his calls with foreign leaders for very good national security reasons. And so I don't know that we're ever going to see the full documentation of all these until, you know, whatever the National Archives laws are that these get released.
So listeners, that's some of the prehistory of what you may already know about Trump-Ukraine, the July 10th meeting in Washington, where John Bolton said he didn't want to be part of whatever drug deal Giuliani and Mick Mulvaney were cooking up. Then the July 25th Trump-Zelensky phone call that prompted the whistleblower to blow the whistle on Trump's apparent threats or bribes regarding military aid, and the series of events in August and September that we've been talking so much about, and that will be largely the focus of the hearings on Wednesday and Friday. But Philip, while you're here, let me touch on some developments from over the weekend.
Sure.
Since the facts are decreasingly in doubt, corroborated by so many people, right, my ear hears the Republican defenders getting ready to rationalize voting against impeachment in various ways and trying to convince the public that removal from office would be wrong in at least two ways that we'll illustrate now. Here is Congressman Matt Thornberry, Republican, on CBS Face the Nation.
The Constitution is very specific: bribery, treason, high crimes and misdemeanors, which basically means felonies. So that's what you have to prove as a threshold question. The second question is, under the circumstances, do you believe that it's good for the country to proceed with impeachment? I would suggest a couple of circumstances are relevant here. Number one is, there's not really anything that the president said in that phone call that's different than he says in public all the time. So is there some sort of abuse of power that rises to that threshold that is different than the American people have been hearing for 3 years? I don't hear that.
Republican Congressman Matt Thornberry on Face the Nation yesterday. So he's arguing, Philip, that high crimes and misdemeanors means felonies.
Right.
We know as a matter of fact that that's right, not true. So I'm going to dismiss that one, though we may hear it again.
Right.
But also that Trump solicits foreign campaign interference right out in public. We all remember Russia, are you listening? Find those Hillary Clinton emails from 2016 at a campaign rally. And he was tweeting that Ukraine should investigate the Bidens and 2016 before the whistleblower, and you know, before before the whistleblower made this public, and before the secret Zelensky phone call came out, like some of what we were referencing in the timeline.
Right.
So Thornberry is asking, what's changed? Why all of a sudden this thing that Trump keeps doing, suddenly you're going to impeach him for it? You think we'll hear that argument more?
Yeah, oh, absolutely, 100%. I mean, it's an odd argument. It's sort of like saying if you mug someone in front of a police station, you should be allowed to get away with it. I think that we've already heard Democrats sort of throw up their hands and say, yes, exactly, this is the point, is that Donald Trump is engaging in behaviors, leveraging his power in a way that he's not authorized to do or should not be doing. But yes, I mean, to your point, broadly at the outset, that there are a lot of rationalizations that are emerging here. It is certainly the case that Republicans on Capitol Hill are not eager to be the public face of opposition to President Trump. He still is very popular with the Republican Party. And I think that there will be a lot of, just deep enough rationalizations to actually get them past the impeachment vote.
And here's Trump's former UN ambassador, Nikki Haley, on NPR today. And I think this is surprising some people because she's been seen as having relatively clean hands, basically agreeing that Trump did it and it's wrong, but then saying this about impeachment and removal.
I just strongly believe that it's arrogant of Congress to turn around and take this from the American people in an election year. The American people should decide what they think is right and wrong. For Congress or Pelosi and Schumer to sit there and say they are going to go and decide this for the American people, it's just wrong. And I think that, you know, we have to be able to give the facts, be as transparent as possible with the American people, and let them decide on election day.
So again, Philip, how central an argument do you think this will become? Because if you look at the history of the other three impeachment processes in U.S. history, Clinton had already been reelected. Nixon had already been reelected. And Andrew Johnson had not even been elected. Right. He became president because Lincoln was killed. It's fair to say at least that this is unique in American history, that an impeachment process is going on into the very year when the public would get to weigh in.
Yeah, I'd say three things about Haley's comments. The first is that she has the most complex political machinations sort of operating about her right now of anyone in the Republican Party. She's clearly thinking about some sort of higher office. It's not clear what exactly the line she's drawing here is. The second is, this is sort of an ironic continuation of the Scalia's death argument, which was Mitch McConnell saying, well, sorry, we got to wait until people actually vote here before we can fill the Supreme Court seat. It's the only fair thing to do. So it's sort of that reemerging here. But I think broadly speaking, it is obviously the case, I think, that there should be some mechanism for there to be a way to remove a president beyond election, right? I mean, we have this at all sorts of levels of government. I lived in California at the time that Gray Davis, who was the governor, was recalled, you know, even though there was, of course, another chance that for him to vote him out of office. But that was people of California decided he needed to go, right? And so they're
Remind
all,
us, what did he do that was worthy of recall?
Oh, he was unpopular. I mean, it was basically no more than that. He wasn't involved in really scandalous behavior. He, like, increased the gas tax.
And that wasn't an impeachment by the legislature, though. That was a recall in a popular election.
Exactly.
Right?
But it was a mechanism for removing him from office before his term was up.
And,
right?
Of course, many Democrats, and this is a big constitutional argument and argument about what's required to preserve a democracy. Many Democrats will say, we've got to do this for the sake of democracy. You can't let a president do something, some things that are this bad and not take action, whereas Haley and other Republicans are arguing that it's bad for democracy for the legislative branch to do this. And so that's a big argument the country will be having.
But I would also say in this specific case, there also is, I think, a fair argument to be made that Donald Trump is specifically trying to affect the outcome of the 2020 race by targeting Biden. And so should it be the case then that an election that he is actively trying to taint is the one which decides whether or not he gets to remain in office?
Another question on that from Stephen in Teaneck. You're on WNYC with Philip Bump from The Washington Post. Hi, Stephen.
Hi there, Brian. I have a question. One of the conspiracy theories that I've heard both Trump and Giuliani come up with is that the Democratic National Committee...
I take it you're still stuck in Halloween, Giuliani. Is that where you went? Is that what you went? Is that where you went as? I'm sorry, go ahead.
That the server itself is actually in Ukraine. And I'm just wondering, isn't that something that somebody can actually just track down and locate? And has any effort been made to do that?
It's a good question. And one of the things that Trump has tweeted and that's part of this theory, tell me how much is based in reality, if any, that when the FBI came to ask the Democratic National Committee for its computer server, after the Russia investigation had already started, presumably hacked by the Russians, they didn't give up the server. And the theory, the conspiracy theory, is the server is in Ukraine.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
but where is the server?
Okay. So there isn't really a server as such. So essentially, the DNC was using a cloud-based networking system, right? And so their servers were, I don't remember which service they were using, but it was on their hosting provider, had a number of servers that were set aside to use for them for their email and their networking and so on and so forth. There were I forget what the term is, but basically, they captured the contents of the computers that were affected, which, of course, is like, it's not like recreating a photo or something along those lines. These are perfect copies of the computers that were affected by these hacks. That information was turned over to the FBI. It was also used by CrowdStrike to do the initial analysis of who would hack this. So it isn't the case that there was like a server in a closet at the FBI. I think to some extent Trump and his allies may be conflating it with Hillary Clinton's email server, but it's not that there was a server there that they then took and burned in the back. This was all online and cloud-based, and they had all the information they needed.
That's fascinating. I did not know that answer. There was no server. It was in the cloud.
Right.
All right, back to this weekend. Trump tweeted that he might release a rough transcript of an earlier conversation with President Zelensky from when Zelensky first got elected back in April. Why might he do that?
I think he wants to do that because he wants to project. He has focused a lot of energy on this transcript as being flawless, perfect,
The
July one, yes, correct. And I think that he recognizes potentially that there isn't much in that April transcript. Obviously, I have no idea what he actually said to Zelensky at that point. But if he puts that out as well and is like, look, see, I didn't say anything then either, then it reinforces his narrative that the only important thing are the transcripts.
So it's like saying, I didn't rob a bank in April, so ignore the one I robbed in July.
Yes, without drawing that analogy too closely, yes.
And finally, the Republicans let it be known this weekend that they want to call Hunter Biden and the whistleblower as witnesses for these televised hearings. Let's leave the whistleblower aside for a second because we're running out of time. I think people get that, you know, the argument against that is that, A, the whistleblower stuff is irrelevant now because all these direct witnesses, people involved from John Bolton on down, you know, have said things themselves about what they were actually involved with. So whatever the whistleblower heard, we're way beyond that, and also ethically to protect the privacy of the whistleblower. So I think we know the arguments against that. But what about Hunter Biden? Do the Democrats solely get to decide if the Republicans may call Hunter Biden?
Well, they do. They are in the majority. They are get to sign off on what the witness list actually looks like. I think there will be pressure on the Democrats to allow at least one or two of these witnesses simply because they want to show it as being as open as possible. I think that's why the witness list is what it is, because it's a lot of people. I think, honestly, the most fascinating person on that list is Alexander Chalupa, who is that DNC staffer who is the one who was seeking the information on Manafort, which is very much a totally separate issue. It has nothing to do with what President Trump did with Zelensky, what he did with Ukraine. But it is an effort to try and bolster this idea that there was something untoward that Ukraine had done. The Hunter Biden thing is interesting. I'm very skeptical, in part because of political reasons, that the Democrats will actually have him be a witness. But it's clear that what the Republicans are hoping to do is to continue to be able to paint this as something where they did not have a part in it in any substantial way.
What would the Democrats' excuse be for not allowing the Republicans to call Hunter Biden? I could imagine the Republicans making a big thing of this,
right,
and, you know, a lot of people taking this seriously and saying, okay, Democrats, you insist the Bidens did nothing wrong,
right,
so there's nothing to investigate here. Let the guy be answering questions.
I think there's probably two arguments that'll be used. You know, whether or not people accept them is up to them. I think the first argument is that this is calling Hunter Biden and focusing on Hunter Biden does reinforce exactly what Donald Trump wanted to get out of this, which was questions about the Bidens. But then secondarily, it's not clear that Hunter Biden can inform anything about how Trump interacted with Ukraine. The question isn't necessarily why he was making these requests of Ukraine. The question was what he did with Ukraine and the way that he tried to leverage power to do so.
Philip Ump, national correspondent for The Washington Post. Among his many articles is a detailed timeline of what we've been calling the Trump-Ukraine scandal, starting with February 2014. Good reading if you want to dig that deep. Thank you for sharing so much of it with us.
My pleasure.